thank you, Dr. Cantor, and thank you to those of you who posted questions. We do have a number of questions typed in, and so we'll go ahead and get started with the QA session with the questions posted online. And then once we get through those, if we still have time, I can open up the phone lines for questions. So let's see here. Dr. Cantor, since you just finished, I'll start off with questions for you. I believe this one is for you, but Trish, if you want to jump in as well, feel free. What analytical tools like Dreyfleet are used to quantify emissions and reductions, and how is the work coordinated with the FHWA, FTA, and MPO conformity analysis?
Okay, I'll take a piece of that. The first part is how do we quantify those emission reductions? Was that the first?
What analytical tools are used to quantify the emissions and reductions?
Basically, the analytical tools are our models that are used. The models have been developed in concert with the regulatory agencies that I mentioned that were partners. And the duty cycle that is based on, if you will, mileage driven and the powertrain for the various trucks are used in the calculations, and that those are calculated estimating the miles traveled. We have drayage records, and we have the engine and the duty cycle. So through those, we were able to calculate the emissions, and that's what our inventory does on a basis. We don't coordinate with any other agencies beyond those regulatory agencies that are here and partners in this effort. Again, the actual tools for the modeling were done at a level, quite honestly, that I was I'm not a technician in the modeling area, but our technical people working with the regulatory agencies developed those and basically came to agreement these were good tools to use for estimating the emissions reductions.
This is Trish. Just jump in and add to what Dr. Cantor was saying. EPA was involved at the invitation of both ports of Long Beach and Los Angeles in developing their initial emissions estimates in terms of reviewing methodologies and so forth. And I think that they did do the state of the art in terms of what they were trying to do, building a bottom-up inventory. A lot of ports, though, don't have the same level of experience or expertise to bring to it. Some of the smaller ports may be looking for simpler tools, and we certainly have those, and I'll mention a few. One, for example, that's on our EPA website is a best practices document. So this is methodologies and best practices for creating port emissions inventories. So those are for port authorities or others who are looking for that comprehensive, all those different source categories from the big ships to the trucks to the rail and so forth. We have ways to estimate either scaling off of more detailed emissions inventories or ways to develop that emissions look yourself. So that's one resource for you, our best practices document. Another tool that you can use is our diesel emission quantifier. The DEC is what it's been nicknamed, is also on our Clean Diesel website. And the DEC uses emission factors pulled from things like the mobile model and the non-road model, which are EPA models that have been coordinated and developed with peer review and input from our colleagues in DOT. Tool that our SmartWay program uses is the fleet model. The fleet model is used really more from a fleet perspective rather than from sort of a geographic perspective, if you will. And we have a fleet tool for long-haul trucks. So we've recently developed a simple calculator that looks at dray truck operations as well, maybe more relevant to this topic. So we have a number of different tools available to help look at the technologies and get a baseline and after control technologies have been applied, so you can look at different technologies and see what would make sense, what would meet your targets.
Okay, thank you. And actually, in relation to what Trish just spoke about, the best practices document, a question was for Dr. Cantor, in preparing your emissions inventory, did you use the EPA current methodologies in preparing mobile source port-related emission inventories?
Well, I think I take it just reverse. I guess EPA's emission inventory methodologies, I think, were ones that came out of our collaborative efforts. And we have used, I would say, analogous inventories. I'm not sure we use their exact inventory methodology.
Yeah, and I would agree with that, because our best practices document was updated in last April. So clearly we're looking for what various ports are doing and trying to share information and methodologies across ports. And clearly the Southern California ports are one of the first to do these emissions inventories and look at climate gases as well. So there's some very important work done there.
Okay. I'm actually going to jump back to a question for Trish, because there are so many questions for Dr. Cantor coming in. I want to make sure that we address the questions for Trish as well. And that question is DERA for non-attainment area ports also?
Absolutely. The Diesel Emission Reduction Program is for diesel emissions across the country. For our competitions, however, the three national ones, priority is given to non-attainment areas or to areas that show a disproportionate air quality impact. So non-attainment areas tend to do a little better in our competition because of that. But I did highlight a number of areas in attainment that are still stepping forward because of their concerns about the diesel exposure for their communities and want to do something to reduce them.
Okay. And this next question, Trish, I'm not sure if you're able to address it, but it's can the proposed federal rules that require ships to use USLD when within the 200 miles offshore zone be addressed? This will have an increased cost influence of short sea shipping, ships moving to, ships moving to Alaska and the Alaska cruise industry.
Sure. The questioner is asking about our North American emission control area. This is a very important topic because actually next week in London, the International Maritime Organization will be meeting about this. Just to give you some background, since we didn't really cover this in the presentation, the North America ECA is basically a geographically defined part of the U.S. and Canadian waters, and in that area, all ships, domestic and foreign flagged, will have to meet certain requirements in terms of sulfur fuel requirements and engine and emission requirements as well. So under Annex 6 to MARPOL, which is the treaty, the U.S. government, together with Canada, are applying for this status. The boundary would go basically from, you know, Southern California on up through parts of Alaska, Hawaii, and then on the East Coast, the Gulf Coast, through, you know, the Canadian waters. Parts of western Alaska, however, not in this, but we are looking at, you know, ways to examine that. So, you know, what exactly would happen under this? It's a very broad topic, but basically, beginning in August 2012, all ships that would be operating in this ECA would be required to use ECA-compliant fuel or other alternative methods that would achieve, you know, a similar sulfur dioxide reduction. And then after 2016, they'll be required to be meeting Tier 3 NOx emission limits as well. So those are all important pieces. What are the costs and benefits, I think, was part of the question. In terms of the benefits, they're pretty substantial. You know, so many of the most serious non-attainment areas for ozone and PM are affected by these emissions from ships. I think you saw Dr. Cantor's presentation for the port of Long Beach, and I think Los Angeles is also included in his pie charts. Ocean-going vessels were a very large chunk of the emissions that are affecting their port. And although they've been doing a lot with their vessel speed reduction plans and cold ironing and so forth, there's still a fair bit of operational emissions that can be addressed. And that's something for an international role like an ECA. So we're working to make that happen. In terms of benefits, The ECA is expected to prevent approximately 14,000 premature deaths per year in the United States, and that has a monetized value of approximately $110 billion in the U.S. in 2020, so very significant health benefits. The economic costs, by comparison, the overall cost is about $3.2 billion, and the impacts of complying with the program for international ships is expected to be, you know, relatively modest. For example, a ship operating in a route that includes about 1,700 nautical miles of operation in the proposed ECA would increase by about maybe 3%. And this operating increase would raise the cost, for example, of transporting a 20-foot equivalent container by about $18 for that that voyage. So I think that gives you a sense of that. There was also a question about Alaska. We did take a look at some of those in our regulatory impact analysis. And as we were doing some of that, there was also some consideration given for the Great Lakes vessels as well. So be happy to answer that in more detail offline. It's also available on our website if you want to read the report directly.
Okay, great. Thank you for an informative response. Dr. Cantor, I'll turn back to you now. Question for you is there a significant percentage of small business tenants in the Port of Long Beach? If so, are there programs to financially assist small businesses with compliance with clean diesel requirements?
Well, I'll have to divide it up in who constitutes the small businesses. When you talk about our tenants, I would call those large businesses. These are the tenants that operate the terminals, and they actually do get some financial assistance or at least incentives on various programs to help transition them into the project. When we look at the small business entities, I would include the truck drivers and independent owner-operator truck drivers as part of that group of people. And they too, at least under our Clean Trucks program, had offered to them a significant amount of financial assistance to help them transition into new, cleaner trucks. Certainly, when we began the program, there was a large proportion of independent owner operators that didn't have the financial wherewithal to buy a new 2007 compliant truck. And so the ports offered 80% subsidies for a new purchase of a truck to help them get into those. And that subsidy basically would allow them to get into the truck and actually buy it out at the end of the 7-year ownership requirement. For a nominal fee, and they would actually own. So let's say you had a $100,000 heavy-duty on-road diesel truck that was for a new purchase, we would subsidize basically $80,000 of that. So again, we were cognizant of the fact that there is a financial impact, and some companies are better positioned to absorb that initial transition than others, and so we offered more help in those areas.
Okay, great, thank you. Next question, can you give more detail on how truck idling time was reduced so much? Gate control, lower turn times, staging areas with electrical power, APUs, etc.?
Right, a couple of major strategies that were employed here. First was the optimization of gate times, having terminals operating more on a 24/7 type of regimen instead of an 8-to-5, and offering, if you will, incentives to use the night gates and disincentives for using the day gates, particularly during rush hour. That provided significant improvement in turn time, also reduced significant congestion on our roadways, and obviously idling time and the emissions associated with that. So that program was part of it. The second part was that we automated the process through RFID, radio frequency identification readers, for processing of the clean trucks through our gates. That database and that automation really helped expedite the movement of trucks within the program. There are still challenges, as any terminal operator would tell you within, or a truck driver would tell you within some of the terminals, and those obviously are being addressed on an as-needed basis. And I would think that we still have a ways to go in those areas. There are a whole variety of other variables in the mix, including labor agreements and so on, that challenge that. But in terms of things that the ports could actually help affect, the ones that I just cited were very instrumental in increasing turn time.
Okay, thank you. And another question for you. For ships connecting to shore power at the Port of Long Beach, is the electricity rate they are charged competitive with the cost of generating power on the ship? If so, how were you able to secure the competitive rate? And if not, how were you able to convince the ships to plug in and incur the extra cost?
That's an excellent question. Well, let's start with phase one, or point one. Point one is that the rates are not equivalent to generating power on the vessel. That is, if a ship was historically generating its own power with its auxiliary engines, that would still be, if you will, cheaper. In terms of actual dollars expended, the actual cost of plugging in is more expensive, and we have not been able to negotiate a much more favorable rate at this point in time for the provision of power. That being said, we are working actively with our major power provider here in our region to come up with a rate that will be more competitive and help all parties involved. It's complex. It has a lot of regulatory challenges that we're working through. We view this as a very important component of our Clean Air Action Plan, and as I indicated, every new lease renewal, particularly on our container terminals, will require that the vessels be plugged in. It's usually a phasing in so that it isn't from day one that the lease becomes active that those vessels will be plugged in. We work with the terminal operators and their customers, the carriers, to bring in cold iron equipped vessels so that they will be ready to plug in. And I guess it's a general feeling that the cost of additional cost of electricity does pay significant benefits, as Patricia indicated earlier, in terms of the health benefits that accrue to the community and to the region.
Okay. Next question. Are ship speeds monitored to ensure they are traveling slower? And if so, who monitors and how is this tracked?
Yes, and that's absolutely essential to have some way to do that. We have our marine exchange, which is basically like a control tower that oversees all the ships, the vessels coming in and out of the ports of LA and Long Beach. They have the ability to track and record the speeds of the vessels as they approach our corridors for slowing down, the 20 and 40 nautical mile corridors. What we actually do is contact the vessel masters and indicate to them that they are entering into that area if they are not already aware of it, and we track and report on the compliance of these vessels. And because for the Port of Long Beach we have an incentive program, we use that data and the records to generate our compliance information that allows us to pay them, if you will, the incentive that we are offering, and we need to make sure that that's documented. So it is an important part of it, and it does exist.
Okay, thank you. And the next question is, are the Class 1 railroads operating into the ports of Long Beach, or I'm sorry, do the Class 1 railroads that operate into the ports of LA and Long Beach operate Tier 2 and 3 compliant locomotives on their trains? Or do you require...
Jennifer Starr?
I apologize. My phone was on mute, and I didn't realize it. Sorry about that. The next question is for Dr. Cantor, and it's, do the Class 1 railroads operating into the ports of L.A. and Long Beach operate Tier 2 and 3 compliant locomotives on their trains into the ports, or do your ports require the railroads to utilize Tier 2 and 3 compliant locomotives? Presumably, your slide on rail emissions reductions reflect both Class 1 and the Port Harbor Belt railroad operations.
Well, the Class 1s have a mixture of Tier 2 and some Tier 3 in their overall national fleet. They have an agreement with our California Air Resources Board for bringing that locomotive power into use under an agreement, a memorandum of understanding that they've established for operating those. Therefore, we at the ports benefit by to the degree that they bring those locomotives in. We do not exert any control over the Class 1s. We do not have the ability to exert that control. You have interstate commerce and other things that preclude us from controlling that. We are working cooperatively with our major line haul railroads to encourage them through any way we can to bring even a more compliant Tier 3 and ultimately Tier 4 locomotive power into this region because of our special needs here. On the other hand, with our switcher operation, as I indicated, they have a contractual agreement with the ports of LA and Long Beach, and through that contractual agreement and the leverage that we have in that, we were able to assist and require cleaner locomotives participate.
This is Trish. If I could just add as well, the question sort of refers to moving from, you know, one tier to another within the locomotive class. It's also the case that some of the switchers and some of the long haul even are moving to these genset approaches. So they're basically taking non-road engines and putting them in a series so that when they need full power, they can run a bank of, say, four of them. When they need less power, they can just run a small one of those four, for example. And a lot of the railroads are finding that that's a tremendous fuel savings to them and a benefit in terms of the operation. So that's just something to keep in mind in terms of, you know, if you're thinking about the tier process, it's also the case that some of them are going to this genset approach, and the non-road engine tiering kicks in a little bit sooner for some of those.
Okay, thank you. The next question, I think we somewhat answered this before, but what technology do you use to monitor vessel emissions on a real-time basis?
Well, for us, we have real-time monitoring stations here, but understand that does not really give you a total picture, because you need a regional series of a real-time monitoring stations. It does provide some ground truth. So the emission inventory where we report the annual emissions from vessel operations is again used or generated through modeling. And again, the methodologies have been established in concert with the EPA, the California Air Resources Board, and AQMD, as well as our technical staff. And so those are a consistent approach to how we generate those figures. But in terms of actual, on a daily snapshot, like I indicated, right now you can go to our website and see what the air quality is, the emissions are out there today, but that is not going to tell you as an overall, it's not going to give you an overall picture of how this is for your entire year.
This is Trish. If the question is asking how do you measure on a ship, we've been using portable emissions measurement techniques and have done some work, for example, with Dr. Wayne Miller at UC Riverside, and he's published a whole bunch of work on those sorts of measurements. So those techniques do exist and are widely reported in the literature as well.
Okay. I'm going to skip down to a question because I think this one makes sense to go first. By now, you should have monitored data from 2005 and 2008. So did the reductions really materialize?
Yeah, I think I showed those in my slide presentation. They absolutely did materialize. We have the data to back it up, we have agreement, if you will, buy-in from the regulatory agencies, which review that inventory data, which shows significant reductions across the board in priority pollutants. We still got a ways to go, and I think none of us are ready to say we've got the job done, but I think we're very, very happy with the progress. So I'd say yes.
And then to follow on to that, do you have an estimate regarding how much of the 2005 to 2008 emission reductions for the Port of Long Beach can be attributed to regulatory measures versus special measures undertaken by the port?
I really don't think I can separate the two. Again, recognize that the regulatory measures that I refer to, for instance, CARB cold ironing rule or shoreside electricity, really, even though it's been promulgated, it hasn't really come into effect or won't come into effect until 2014. I do believe that some of the emissions that we showed from the vessel, reductions that we showed on the vessels, particularly with regard to the use of refined product, the MGO and MSO fuels, refined product being burned in their auxiliaries, help contribute to the reductions, particularly at berth emissions that we experienced here. But what percentage, I'm not sure I could quantify that.
Okay, thank you. Another question for Abby, and the question is, a number of recent Tiger grants provide for infrastructure improvements at and to ports. Did DOT and EPA confer on how to prioritize these investments, or on how to make EPA, DERA, and DOT, Tiger, and CMAQ investments about ports complementary? From the DOT side, someone from the DOT will likely follow up in terms of that question. We don't currently have someone on the line from there who can answer that, but I did want to put it out to Trish, to you, to see if, your thoughts.
Well, I know that EPA and DOT coordinate on a number of things at very high policy levels. I can't speak directly to the Tiger grants, but in terms of DERA, we certainly want to coordinate on the CMAQ side, because as I mentioned, when we have the American Recovery and Investment Act applicants come in, we had $2 billion worth of projects, and a number of those could be things that could be funded by CMAQ. You know, existing projects, partners ready to go, their own resources ready to match. You've seen a very extensive list here from the Port of Long Beach in terms of the things they want to do and are continuing to make progress towards to meet the air quality goals on the deadlines to get the nation the clean air that they deserve. It's important that we move some of these technologies forward faster than we have been. And I think that coordinating and using the CMAQ process to use some of these very cost-effective technologies would be a great thing to be doing, and I'm very pleased that we're able to have those conversations to try to make that happen.
Okay, thank you. That's all the questions I see typed in. Trish or Dr. Cantor, are there any questions that might have been sent directly to you that I may have not seen?
I'm just checking my email now. I don't see any at this point.
Okay. And Trish, was there anything that you noticed in the chat area that I missed that might have been for you?
No, I don't see any.
Okay, well, at this point, please continue to type in questions if you have any, but we'll also, for the people on the phone, give you an opportunity to ask questions over the phone. So if the operator could give instructions on how to do that, we'll just wait a few seconds to see if any questions come in over the phone. And again, like I said, if you still think of questions to type in, feel free to continue doing that as well. Do we have anything on the phone?
I have no questions.
Okay, well, I think if there are no more questions, we'll go ahead and end a little bit early then. As I'm reading the closeout, if you do think of anything, feel free to type it in. But I do want to thank both of our presenters for a great seminar today and lots of good information. Thank you, everybody in attendance, for attending on this St. Patrick's Day. The recorded version of today's seminar will be available online within the next few weeks, and I'll send an email out once the recording is available, as well as a transcript and the presentations. As a reminder, if you're an AICP member and would like to receive 1.5 certification maintenance credits for attending the seminar, please make sure you were signed in today with your first and last name, or if not, if you could type your name into the chat box. Please also download the evaluation form and email it to me after you've completed it. And also, you can download the STEAM credit instructions if you're unsure of how to obtain your credits for today's seminar. You do need to go to the AICP website to log your credits in order to receive them. For those of you who aren't AICP members, I still invite you to download the evaluation form and submit it to me. Your feedback is always welcome. The next seminar will be held on April 21st and will be about non-traditional freight data sources. I don't believe that's actually open for registration yet. We're working on it, so it should either be open today or tomorrow, but I'll send an email out once it does become open for registration. If you haven't done so already, I also encourage you to join the Freight Planning Listserv. Announcements for all future Talking Freights are sent out through the listserv, as well as other freight information from across the country. With over 600 members, it is a great resource for sharing and obtaining freight information. So with that, we'll close out. Have a great St. Patrick's Day, everybody, and enjoy the rest of your day.